Today is Thursday, April 13th, 2017. This is panel number 4301, titled U.S. Immigration, Give Me Your Tired and Poor. Something to certainly reflect upon. For those of you who have been attending the sessions, this is probably not news to you, but in this CWA session, we'll utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and a pencil from one of our producers, and then give your question to the producer. And if you're a student, please note that you're a student on your question because CWA gives priority to students' questions. My name is Christina Sue, and I'm a professor of sociology here at the University of Colorado, and it's definitely my pleasure to moderate this panel. I'm moderating it both because one of the areas of my own research is immigration, and also because I have my class here in the audience. I teach a class on race and immigration, and they were able to attend. So in terms of the structure of the panel, we'll proceed as follows. Each panelist will be given 6 to 8 minutes to make an opening statement. And after everybody has made their opening statements, we'll have some time for them to each respond to each other's opening statement and have more of an open discussion. And then for the final approximately one-third of the session, we will have take questions from the audience. I will have your questions if you send in an app, and we'll have the note cards up here. Although the panel runs until 12:15, we'll be taking a 30-second break at 11:50 for any of the students who need to leave to get to other classes, since the regular time period for our class is 11 to 11:50. Okay, it is my pleasure to introduce our panelists. They will be speaking in the order that I introduced them, which is also the order in your in the brochures. First, Del Garcia on the far end is visiting us from Texas. She is the Director of International Projects, Research and Development for Migrant Clinicians Network, where she focuses on meeting the health needs of migrants and other underserved communities. She has conducted research on disparities in the provision of health care and the trauma that migrants undergo when crossing international borders, among other things. Second, we have Vicki Huddleston, who's joining us from New Mexico, and she's also coming back to Boulder. She was an international affairs major here, so she is an alumni. She has served as U.S. ambassador to Mali, Madagascar, and Ethiopia, and has worked as the coordinator of Cuban affairs at the U.S. State Department with a specific focus on normalizing U.S.-Cuban relations. I had read this, so she can correct me if I am wrong, but that in the early 1990s that she was attending a diplomatic event in Cuba where she first met Fidel Castro, and she was one of two women in the room, and he approached her and said, "Who are you, someone's spouse?" And she responded, "No, I'm the director of Cuban affairs." And he subsequently responded, "I thought I was." And they had a nice conversation after that. And finally, Reza Ramazani is joining us from Vermont, but he too is coming back to Boulder, having received his MA and PhD here. He is a professor of economics at St. Michael's College. His research is focused on international trade, international finance, environmental economics, and economic development, with a primary specific focus on China. And so without further ado, we can proceed with our opening statements.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for being here. Immigration is a particularly interesting topic for me to consider for two reasons. I do a lot of work internationally, and it is only very recently that this particular appearance has meant North American to many of the places that I travel in the world. I'm received with an enormous amount of skepticism. And when I lived in Brazil in the 70s, they were like, "Don't you ever go out without your passport, because no one will ever believe you." On the other side, personally, I am frequently asked where I'm from. And it's a nice opening question for most people. And I say, "I'm from Texas." And they were like, "What, before, where were you from?" Really, my family's always been in Texas. You moved the border, you left us here, we're from Texas. So it has some poignancy for me in my work and then in my personal walk through the world. And I think that what I struggle with frequently is the dual narratives that we seem to really drive here in the U.S., which is, you know, that We're a land of immigrants, and it is the vitality of immigrants and the immigration process that makes us strong. And then on the other hand, and we are being overrun by the hordes, and that people should make every effort to get here legally. And when I try and look at those questions and the dichotomy that presents, you know, and I look at the pieces that I think really push and pull, although those are really not the terms that I would like to use, but play in terms of immigration, that we would really need to then look at the systems of immigration. And when we talk about changes to immigration policy and deep consideration of those policies, I think that there is a lot that many people who are just reading the newspaper don't understand. And a big element of that are the quotas, which is that there are a certain percentage of opportunities for people to come here with authorization based on where they are in the world. And you can guess that those areas that are, you know, sort of white European have much better percentages than those that are brown and southern poor. And then I think that whole process of you can cast your lot and join the lottery and potentially get a visa. Otherwise, you're going to have to go through an incredibly protracted process that can take years, decade, more. And so when you look at how that system is constructed, and the moving jump rope that is trying to immigrate legally to the United States, where do you jump in? And how do you do so successfully? And I think that very often from the U.S. side, what we don't consider is that the way things are constructed in this world, when we look at cost, we want the most of the best for the cheapest price possible. And if that is your goal, then, you know, you really need to look at labor in this country, which is the second piece, I think, of this that we often don't look at in combination, which is that there are many jobs in this country that people do not want. People don't grow up thinking, I want to be a farm worker. And when you hear what work is out there that's really important, that is driving the economy in many places, for example, in Georgia, chicken processing is a huge industry. It is a major engine for that state in terms of revenue. And yet if you've ever walked near a chicken processing plant, you know you are there because the smell of warm blood and excrement is overwhelming. And you have people who, they run 24 hours a day, three shifts, you go in, you're on the line, you're plucking, you're dismembering, you're packaging. And I remember that there was a real long battle about, oh, we have these people coming from El Salvador, because those are the majority of the workers in the chicken processing plant, and they're taking our jobs. And one of the processors said, okay, you know what? We're going to have open hiring tomorrow morning. You get here at 4 o'clock, you sign up, you qualify at a minimum, which is that you can hear well enough to understand instructions and that sort of stuff. We'll put you on the line. So they took all comers. By the morning break at 10, about 10% had left. By noon, almost 50% didn't come back after lunch. And by the end of the day, you had people walking out saying, let them have these jobs. I don't want to do this. And so that is the other side of that whole argument about labor and costs. And then I think another element that is particularly vexing and painful to me is, you know, that I don't want my tax dollars wasted on the undeserving. And, you know, when we look at what few services in this country truly are provided in comparison to other regions in the world, I'm really taken aback and quite saddened that we begrudge people access to health care, that we make it almost impossible for people to find and keep decent housing, that jobs are difficult to hold on, and it's much better to either make them contract so that they come without the benefits, or we make them 34 hours or less so that they don't qualify. You know, that there are all of these manipulations put in place so that individuals really can't benefit from the few things that are brought about. And when I saw the work that was done with the ACA, with the with the recent move to try and bring people to affordable care. I was also struck by the fact that the only way they could get the ACA through was that they explicitly excluded undocumented immigrants. So when I look across the United States and I look across the 30 years of my work that I've been involved in migrant health, and I think about what all has been brought to this country by the dynamism of those who have the wherewithal to get here, and let me tell you, the Arizona desert is nothing to trifle with, and the labor that they are willing to engage in, and the vigor with which they put their children in school. Ooh, now I'm going to cry. And their joy at participating in community. I'm overwhelmed that it continues to be an issue to this day. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to be here. I was going to start out and just list some immigrants. There's a lot of famous ones. One right next to me, of course. But I thought I'll do that in a little bit because I have to play with my phone. But I thought I'd start out with a story. I was acting ambassador in Ethiopia. And I went to see Lucy. Lucy is a 2 to 3 million year old, 40% complete fossil of a pre-human. And she's named Lucy because her discoverers, anthropologists from Arizona and the University of Addis Ababa, were listening to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy now resides, most people believe, in a museum in Addis at the university, and you look at her through a glass case. But in fact, the real bones of the real Lucy are down in the basement. And I went down with a professor, and we came to one of these typical rooms that you have in universities and labs with the long drawers. And he first pulls out one, oh, wrong drawer. Then he pulls out another, ah, here's Lucy. And he takes this big drawer and he puts it here on the table. And imagine you're looking at this 2.5 million year old ancestor. And I'm like this, can I touch? And I did. It was, you know, an amazing thing, because you just, that kind of contact that goes back so many millions of years. So then I decided I would have to go to the place where Lucy was discovered. When the continents broke apart, the African plate separated from the Arabian plate and it formed the Red Sea. And that created the lowest place now still in the earth, the Danakil Plateau, or undersea plateau almost, the seas filling it up, and the Great Rift Valley of Africa, which you've all heard of because of the marvelous animals there. And so Lucy was found outside Hadar in the Afar Danakil Depression. And when I went there, we went by car. Then we found a village, and we found a guide, a Somali, with an AK-47. And then we found a path, and then we just went wherever he said. And eventually got out, walked down. And as we walked through this completely white, barren, chalk cliffs, under our feet was crunch, crunch, crunch. And in fact, we were walking on the bones of, you know, millions and millions of years old animals, and perhaps pre-humans as well. And we reached the dune in which Lucy was found. It was just kind of like this amazing moment. And I could just imagine how they must have felt when they made this amazing discovery. So why tell you this story? Because after Lucy came humans, and those humans walked out of Africa to colonize the earth. They walked into Europe, and they walked into Asia, and they walked across the land bridge into what is today the Western Hemisphere and the United States. So we're all Africans. We're all immigrants. Even the first group here, the Indians, are immigrants too. So I wonder, when I think back to how the world has been populated by successive movements of people, even colonization, the conquistadores, the Spanish moving into Latin America, the British and the French into North America. This is all immigration. One group pushing out another. Our own country decimating many of the Indian tribes. So what makes us so amazingly special that we should say we don't want immigrants? Especially when immigrants have played such an enormously important part in our own society. In the patent system, more patents, about twice as many, are offered by immigrants. Some of the largest American companies, like Google and Procter and Gamble, were created by immigrants. The great scientist Albert Einstein, the actress Natalie Portman, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Wernher von Braun, Ian Pei, the great architect that has a building here right outside of Boulder. So I become surprised that we can't remember our own past. This is particularly true what you've said, because your family was here before we took up a big piece of Mexico. And now we say, well, sorry, Mexicans, you know, you can't come in. Yet Texas, California, New Mexico, Arizona, parts of all of them were at one time parts of Mexico. It is absolutely valid for the United States to have borders and to protect its borders, particularly in a time of global terrorism. But we can't forget our own background, our moral obligation to human rights, to humanity, and to those who are fleeing from oppression, from political upset in their country. We can't take everyone, but yet our immigration has plateaued. Mexicans are not coming here in great numbers. In fact, more Americans are now going to Mexico than Mexicans coming here. Illegal immigration last year or the year before was basically under about 400,000, and it was Asian, Central American, and some African. So immigration is a phenomena that we have to deal with in a humane way, and we have to deal with in a way in which we look at our past, at their contributions as well. So I would just put out an idea, which would be immigrants who have been here for, let's say, 10 years, because 66% of undocumented immigrants in the United States have been here for 10 years. We just say, fine. You've been part of this community. You can remain. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Let me start by saying it's always a pleasure for me to come home to this beautiful city and this wonderful university. And as a college professor, I'm so impressed to see so many students in the audience given the fact that it's beautiful outside. And according to my colleague, your professor didn't have to bribe you or to give you any kind of economic incentive to come to listen to us today. And for that, I'm very grateful. Now, I am on 9 different panels this week, but this one I think is close and personal. And I hope I'm not exaggerating and I'm not disrespectful by making the following statement. I left Iran in 1977. I experienced tough time in this country. First, I want to say I'm very grateful to this country. This country has been good to me. And I hope in a small way I have been good to this country. I remember the difficult time during the hostage situation, and a lot of people were blaming Iran and a student what happened in Iran. We were a hostage ourselves. Then, being in this country for 40 years, I'm not a citizen of the United States. I'm a green card holder from Iran. I'm a legal alien. That's what is in my card. As I'm sure you noticed, a few weeks ago, I was on that famous list of 7 countries originally that dropped to 6. And when I find out that as an Iranian with a green card holder, who is legally has been in this country, and I might not be able to travel, that was devastating for me. I usually don't get much involved with politics, but that day, before I start my class, I needed to talk to my student. I thought that was a teaching moment for me. And I want to put a human face. You read in the paper, you watch the TV, you said, an Iranian green card holder. And I want the student feel and see the human face. And I had to tell him, somebody heard this story probably a couple of days ago in the audience. I apologize for that. But I think it was important for me, you know, to be honest with my student, young people. I said, look, I'm one of those Iranians. I want you to look at me. You have no fear. You shouldn't fear me at all because I don't think in any form and shape, you know, any reason for you to be fearful. And I'm not going to harm anybody, especially my student. And if I want to harm any American, I would have done it long time ago when I was much younger and stronger. Then I told them, the only reason you should fear me or be fearful of me, I think it's important for a student to hear that. If you don't do your work, then you're going to flunk my class. That's the only reason you should be fearful. Now, again, I want to say something else about my experience, and I think it's a perception. Everybody knows my first name. At my school, everybody called me by my first name. And when I introduced myself, I said, I'm just Reza. I don't have a last name, like Madonna and Cher. Except my student called me Professor Dr. Your Highness Ramazani. And you know when they call me Dr. Professor Ramazani? Just a few days before the final exam. Now, I just show my driver license to some of my colleagues, but my legal name, official name on government document is Muhammad R. Ramazani. That's the reason I'm telling you, it is not an easy time. Being an Iranian with the green card, legal resident of this country for 40 years, semi-productive member of a society, but when people look at the name Muhammad, I think that they mean a change. And I'm not one of those people, you know, that I want to complain and I'm saying I'm a victim. I'm not a victim. It's a sad reality that I have to face it. And I think I want to add something else because I have numbers. I want to talk about it maybe later on during the question and answer. I think, but the personal story is important. I met my German wife at this lovely institution. So it was a package deal for me to come to see you, get your PhD, and you get your also future wife. Buy one, get the second one free, which I'm very happy. Our daughter, who's a third year medical student, is really, it was devastated on what happened, you know, after the announcement. And she was extremely nervous. She said, "Dad, I know it's a domestic flight. I'm very worried about you." I said, "Sweetheart, don't worry about me. I cannot stop living. I have to do what I'm supposed to do." But in order to make sure she's not nervous, I went to the dean of college and I got a letter that indicated I'm a college professor. I've been doing it for 4 years. And I also notarized it in case when I'm leaving Denver midnight on Sunday. And it's not a bad thing to have. But let me know, saying this. So the argument for and against immigration are much political, moral, as they are economics. So I want to stay away from the political part of it for obvious reason, because I don't want to be deported. And now I have to wear two different hats. I have to show some compassion, especially as an immigrant. I don't want to be one of those immigrants that I got in, I made it, therefore let's shut down the door. Okay? We don't want those people. They talk funny. But I'm pull and push when I look at the issue of immigration. First, I have to show some compassion as an immigrant myself. But as an economist, I have to be realistic because I preach about scarcity. What type of immigration are we talking? Are we going to have an open border to accept everyone? Which from the compassionate part, my answer is yes, we should do it. But I hate to say it, it might not be practical. It might not be realistic. We might not be able to provide them with what they need in order to succeed. So I want to make sure that I get it. There is a challenge between those two. The morality, the compassion part, and also the economics part. The realistic part of the immigration argument. So I don't know if I have time to provide the audience with some facts. These are from good sources. They are not alternative facts. There are a lot of perceptions. As you know, people, and I do the same thing. I'm as bad as everybody else. I got to make it very clear. Economists, especially politicians, when they look at the issue, like trade or especially immigration, they concentrate on the aspect of the issue that is going to serve their purpose. I think my job as a professor of economics for many years is to be truthful to my student and tell the complete story. This is one side of the story, this is another side of the story, and then we have to let the student make the decision for themselves. So you have heard those aliens like me, they come to this country and take our job away, and they're going to cause a lot of economic problems. And I said, it is very easy, and I don't blame politicians, I totally get it. We're looking for a scapegoat. We are trying to make this complicated issue very simple. We get all of our information from the media. And now we have a designer media. You have one for a progressive, one for Republican, one for, you know, Democrat. So tell us what kind of news you'd like to see and we're going to live. So let's look at some data here, if I may, and then you can always stop me and we can really continue during the question and answer. Census data, as I said, these are good sources, these are facts, these are not alternative facts. Data shows that more than 40 million foreign-born people are living in the United States, and half of them are citizens. I'm not belong to that half. And each year, about 1.5 million new immigrants arrive, and most of them are legal. Now, let me just identify the source of the data. The data is from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. So it's not a cook-up data. Immigrants boost economic growth in the long run and modestly improve the country's demographic portfolio as the native population ages, and that's a very important point, especially in the state of Vermont. One of our biggest challenges, we have an older population, and that's going to have a very, it's going to be challenging task for a lot of policymakers in the state of Vermont, and we keep ignoring it because you've got to make a drastic changes how you deliver services to your older population. Immigration also create a small net benefit. Net benefit, I mean, we look at the cost, we look at the benefit, we see if the number is positive or negative, and we call it immigration surplus, not a deficit, but the surplus. Is around $50 billion a year. The net benefit or immigration surplus is $50 billion a year, which increases the income of average native poor American around half a percentage point. Again, as a positive effect, it might not much, and it contradicts what we hear in the media that immigration has a negative impact on economic well-being of America. That might not be completely correct. Now here, there is a caveat. Where do we get this net benefit? I gotta be very honest. When people like me, and when those, we have some of us undocumented people, believe it or not, in a state of Vermont, and I totally agree with you, there are not that many native Vermonters, God bless them, good people. They don't want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of winter, in Vermont, to go and milk those cows. And let's be frank. I talked to some of them. They cuss at those undocumented. You know, yes, I'm willing to do it. Number one, they're willing to do it, but not at the same wages. I don't know if... Forgive me. I don't know if the work ethic is there because they haven't experienced the same kind of a hardship that other people in other poor countries experience. When we come to this country, we are very grateful. We don't advertise or brag about what we do. We put our head down and we do the work. So very quickly, where do we get that $50 billion? Yes, in the short run, it's going to reduce wages. So the wages in the short run is going to drop by $500 billion. And that's what people really concentrate. But on the other hand, the profit of some of the producers will go up by $550 billion. So there is a net benefit of 50. So some people argue, say, wait a minute, this is a distribution of income from workers to capital, from labor to capital. That's not completely true. Because if as a corporation I am receiving some benefit, then I can reduce the prices for all American consumer, especially including the people that are complaining and cussing at the immigrant. So that's the reason I'm going to tell those people, yes, there is negative effect. There is a positive effect. Look at your income, because lower prices, your income increased during the year by half a percentage point. So I think we've got to tell the complete story. This is a good side, this is a bad side, and this is an ugly side, and people have to make a decision. But decision is not really based on economics. The decision, the argument for or against it is based on what morality, and is based on a politics. So I'll let you make that the decision if that's good or bad. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I went over time.
Thank you to all of our panelists. And just a quick reminder that if you want to, I'm already receiving some questions, just go ahead and send those in. And we have Millie who's walking around with note cards if you don't have a smartphone. This is an unusual panel, I think unusual in a very good way, in that we have such a diverse range of experiences, you know, going from community to government to academia, and also with a very broad kind of range of expertise in terms of region, right? So I want to open up the floor to the panelists just in case they want to respond to each other's comments. If they don't, I have some questions of my own that I'd like to throw out to each panelist because our areas of expertise are pretty specific.
I just wanted to have the fun of just reading some of these immigrants to the United States. Albert Einstein, Natalie Portman, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Elie Wiesel, Desi Arnaz, Wernher von Braun, Nikola Tesla, Joseph Pulitzer, Irving Berlin, Madeleine Albright, Joni Mitchell, I.M. Hay, and guess who was illegal? John Lennon and Yoko Ono and Charlie Chaplin. Okay, yeah, that only touches on it, Andrew Grove. And also, Colin Powell is the son of immigrants from Jamaica. And Henry Kissinger.
And the rest of us.
And the rest of us.
Okay, so I'm going to, kind of tailor the question a little bit to each of you. And push you a little bit in terms of asking for specifics to the degree that we can and are comfortable speaking about the current administration. So I'm interested about how the recent presidential campaign and Trump's immigration policy, so both discourse and the policies themselves, because I think we all know that just kind of these discussions that are happening about immigration have a huge impact, whether or not they're actually implemented, have impacted your own work and the communities that you're working with. So what are you kind of seeing in terms of your actual expertise? So Del, specifically in terms of the communities that you work with, Vicky, I would love to hear kind of your expert opinion on how is this affecting kind of relationships with other countries and where are we going? Reza, questions like, what are economists being asked to answer now in terms of the most pressing question? So I think a lot of these conversations could have happened in the past, and I would specifically be interested in hearing about what's different now.
Well, I would have to say that both discourse and policy have had enormous effect. When I think about discourse and the coarsening of, I think, the U.S. discourse around immigration, from a personal perspective, at 60, I've never been this afraid in my life. I have been in a couple of positions now where someone has felt at complete liberty to say something to me that I would never have assumed could be said to my face. So there's that. The other piece is what gets said out loud then by individuals now has full cover of, I'm just telling you my truth. Which then leaves me in the position to say, gosh, then your truth is that you really are a racist and a bigot. But I don't say that out loud. And so for me, I'm not quite sure how to navigate the discourse in many of the places that I find myself. What I see that it has done to the communities that I work with is that we now have health centers across the country reporting to us that there are no-show rate, individuals with appointments who then do not appear at the day of and time of their appointment, has increased by 50% because people are afraid. You have children now that are not wanting to leave their home. If the message that everybody is receiving is if there's a knock on the door, don't open the door. Where you have immigration officers parked at the driveway of the hospital, where you have a woman from Guatemala who was in deportation process, absolutely, but she was in the hospital for a brain tumor, and they removed her from the hospital. So what I see happening to me is this: the discussion and what is said about the policy. We are only going to, deport those who currently have some kind of criminal proceedings on the books. They've committed some crime. Well, entering this country without authorization is a crime. It's a federal crime. So anyone who's here in an undocumented status, unauthorized, has committed a crime. So to say, we're just holding it to those who are the most dangerous, is not true. And what is also true in absolute application is that any city, like Austin, Texas, which is where I live, that tried to step forward and say to its citizens, we will protect you, we will, as much as we can, be a sanctuary, those cities got targeted by ICE. Those are the places that ICE went first and started questioning people on the street, picking them up on their way home from work, on their way to work from taking their kids to school, to definitely show the mayor and the city council and concerned citizens, you can say whatever you want. You are impotent in the face of American immigration.
I don't want to make this session very technical, but when we talk about immigration, I think it's important, you know, we distinguish between legal, illegal, and also the refugees. So I want to make sure, you know, we are able to make that distinction. For me, I think it's a fear factor. The debate about immigration for the past 40 years, for me being in this country, is nothing new. We always discuss the question of immigration, especially during elections, so it's nothing new. But what is really different these days, you know, is the current election. When an individual promised that he's going to make a big, beautiful wall, you know, on the U.S.-Mexican border, and also dealing with the illegal immigration. Even if the individual didn't mean it, you know, and I just used that one as a tool to be elected, I think that causes a lot of fear, you know. And I want to say this. I just explained this story. I told you about myself. If a legal resident who is a college professor in this country for 40 years has a fear of traveling domestically, can you imagine how those undocumented Mexicans are going to feel, even in the progressive, beautiful state of Vermont? And I have to tell you this, as a young person growing up in Iran during the Shah's regime and now, you know, under the mullahs, that lack of a trust, that's the fear, has a devastating effect on the population. I remember vividly growing up as a child. My parents said, shh, you never discuss any of these issues outside the house. So I grew up not trusting a lot of people. And that's, honestly, God, has a lot of consequences. You know, there's some, and I have a story to tell you when I came here, especially about the African American, because I learned most of the American culture watching American movie in Tehran. And I have such a distrust and fear of African American. And I'm ashamed how I reacted when I got to this country in March 1977 and when African American woman wanted to help me with my luggage, when I wanted to transfer a bus from one side of the street to another. I had to push her because I thought she was going to grab my bag and run away. And those are the difficult things that people don't see it, don't feel it, and we can't really measure them, put it in terms of numbers. So what I have done lately, because as I told you, this issue, I don't want to get involved with politics, but because this is a close and personal. And I think, especially as a college professor, I have a moral obligation. I have to speak up. I have to speak up on behalf of those undocumented, you know, Mexican that helping our economy in Vermont to grow. Because I have to tell some of the Vermonter, yes, let's native Vermonter do those jobs. If we offer them 5, 10, 20 times, you won't be able to afford to buy the milk to take care of your kids. And again, I'm not going to make any political statement. I'm not going to be disrespectful to American native. I'm not going to say I'm better, I'm more productive. But I hate to say it, we're all the same. We're all the same. I'll be honest with you, I tell my student, I said, we all immigrant. If you don't trust me, check with your parents, check with your grandparents. We all came to this country from someplace else. The only difference, your great-grandparents got here a little bit earlier than I did, maybe with a different means of transportation. That's only the difference. And by the way, we have a large number of international students. And I'm sure you folks noticed that I have a Bostonian accent. So, you know, I'm not from Texas like her. I'm from Boston Garden. And that's, I think, is the key. Because the international student, very shy, very nervous. And I have to protect those kids, too. I have to tell my American student, first of all, we've got to be very realistic. And we're grateful to international students because they're the one, they're paying the full tuition and helping American students, be honest with you, to be that college. That's one thing. The next thing is, they are nervous because they don't want to participate. They don't want to talk. They're worried about their accent. And I have to tell them, everybody has an accent in this country. And I use my accent as an advantage. I'm not shy about it. And I'm telling my students, especially the kids from Boston Garden, that I want they participate. I want they express themselves. And I have no problem understanding their funny accent. So, jokingly but seriously, I want to say we are the same. We honestly, we're all the same. And I think we have to respect each other. And I want to say, not only college professor, the guy with the big head who can't say I'm a productive member of a society. I want to also include undocumented immigrant. They have been, yes, maybe it's, they broke the law. I understand that part of it, you know. But we have to be, deal with that, the reality. We've got to do something. We can't just say, okay, let's put them in the bus and ship them back to Mexico where they came from.
Well, Christina said I should talk to some degree about how we're seen overseas. And it isn't just Trump, although I think the discourse and the alternative facts that we've heard from the president certainly denigrate our image overseas. But I look back to the time I was here at CU, and it was when Kennedy died. I really remember very well walking across the campus and the bells in Old Main tolling. And then I went into the Peace Corps, and we were just seen as a great country. You know, I was this American Peace Corps volunteer in Peru, and everybody admired the Alliance for Progress and Kennedy and our great country. It's what happened. I remember Ronald Reagan going to Germany and saying, tear down that wall. And now we build walls. And we're seen as a country that builds walls. Much of the reason that we're no longer seen as that shining symbol that the Statue of Liberty represents is because of the conflict in the Middle East. We begin to be seen as taking sides, of being oppressive, and that has continued even with the current wars, because so many people see the wars as creating huge refugee flows. Some see the wars as being carried out illegally or unfairly because we use drones and we use tea lamps, which keep our people safe, but seem to keep us out of the conflict to some extent. So a part of it is not all our own fault, but I think a big part is our own fault, because somehow we seem to have become divided, to have lost our way, and not to have put people in positions of, and to have put people in positions of power who really represent the things that we should be the least proud of. Throwing out immigrants, arbitrary arrest, sexism, things like that. And so I'm glad this is a young student audience, because you got to fix the mess. You need to get out and be activists, and you need to vote, and you need to get America back on track.
Thank you again. We're going to take a quick 30-second minute break for those of you who need to run to other classes.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
You're welcome to stay if you don't have another class.
You'd hate to lose our audio.
I know.
Okay. great. Thank you. We're going to have one more comment. I'm going to open again for any comments from the panelists before we, and I'm going to transition a little bit early to questions from the audience because I'm getting a ton of them and they're great, so I'm going to forfeit my own questions, but first just want to open up to all of you.
If I may, I want to say, because the question from Christina was, what role should we play, or what is my role, you know, as an immigrant, as a professor dealing with a lot of young people? You know, a group of economists, there are almost, I believe there are 1,500 economists. We send a petition to the president and the Congress and explaining why he needs to tone it down a little bit, you know, when it comes to immigration. And I'm very grateful to report that really the president is making some adjustment now. He doesn't really accuse China of being a currency manipulator. And he doesn't really want to get rid of the NAFTA. And I think that's music to my ear. And when my daughter was so nervous after the election, I told sweetheart, you know, a lot of politicians make a lot of statements. That's normal. It's natural in order to get Washington. And then they realize that really is not practical. It's not realistic. They get a dose of a reality, and they're making an adjustment. So I want to give our president some credit. And I get in trouble with some of my colleagues. Oh, you're exaggerating. You know, he's not doing much. But when the bar is low, any adjustment, I think, is an improvement. I know I'm going to get in trouble, but that's okay. Now, this was our rationale when we sent a petition to the president and as a group of economists. The first one is immigration brings entrepreneurs. You mentioned a lot of them. Entrepreneurs who start new businesses that hire a lot of American workers. And that's the fact. The second one, immigration brings young workers who help offset the large-scale retirement of the baby boomers. I already mentioned my beloved state of Vermont. And that's the fact, folks. See? Next, immigration brings diverse skill set that keep our workforce flexible, help companies grow, and increase the productivity of American workers. Underline, American workers. The most important one. Immigrants are far more likely to work in innovative, job-creating fields such as science, technology, engineering, and math that create life-improving products and drive economic growth. And again, that's the fact.
I just wanted to add one other thing, and when I engage, because my focus is healthcare and health, enlightened self-interest seems like it would be motivating someone's thinking. If you live in rural America, the number of clinicians of healthcare providers that are foreign medical graduates and have come to this country from somewhere other than the U.S. and are willing to live in a place where they don't have access to the amenities that you have in a large urban area and bring a lot of care to an aging population, that would seem really important as well. Because I think that healthcare is one of those pieces that is so difficult for us to be in agreement about how we provide, but its necessity is so without question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you again for the questions, and I'm glad they're still coming in. I'm going to lump a group of questions that are been asked by students and non-students, and I think that, you know, the impression from the audience is that the, you know, panel is quite favorable towards immigration, and so there's some harsher questions in terms of being trying to push you all a little bit, harsh yet respectful. And some of the questions are, Reza, you kind of, you know, opened with this saying, you know, there's this, you know, kind of humanitarian perspective and then, you know, kind of the numbers. But asking the hard questions of, well, we can't let everybody in, as Vicky said. So how do we make those decisions? Who comes in? Who is not allowed to come in? How do we protect the United States from terrorism?
how do we manage immigration and at the same time not overly stretch our natural resources? So people are looking for specifics, I think, in terms of how to balance some of these concerns.
That's a great question, and I was expecting that. And that's the reason I really like this conference, because I like when we have people on the panel discussing the issue from a different point of view. I'm a firm believer of diversity based on gender, the color of skin, nationality at the colleges and university. And I'm a firm believer of a diversity of ideas in the classroom. And I think that absolutely is wonderful, especially when we discuss some of these difficult issues with young people. My job is not to brainwash my student. I need to create an environment that my student feel comfortable to challenge me, to say, why do you make that statement? What kind of evidence do you have? And that should be my job and the job of almost every professor. Now, I want to now be myself. I have to be truthful to my profession. I told you it's a question of morality for me, compassion, and also I have to play the role of economist. So I want to be myself, a heartless economist who is going to pick the heart. There is not much, by the way, small heart. I want to put it outside. I want to talk about from economic point of view. We cannot have open border. We cannot, unfortunately, again, it's sad for me to say, but it's a part of reality. We cannot have an open border and accept every refugee and every immigrant. Now I want to provide you with a number. I'm not saying close the door, but we've got to come up with a smarter immigration policy. Some people argue, and in some extent I agree, and I have a number to say, we probably very generous admitting a lot of immigrants from economic point of view might be a good idea to bring the wife, the husband, and the children. Because now I think in some cases we're bringing a lot of uncles, a lot of relatives, and again, it's a good thing to do. It's a compassionate thing to do. It's the right thing to do. But do we have the resources to help all of these people? So the same study that I quoted, and I say a lot of good thing about immigration, but also we have to look at this fact. So if we want to have an open border, if we want to accept all the immigrants, regardless of their skin, and all the refugees, I think that's going to cause us some economic challenges. So we've got to do what this immigrant contribute in the dollar term, in economics term, and what is the cost effect. Some economists like Milton Friedman believe that we cannot have an open border and a very effective welfare system. Those two contradict one another because we might not have all the money to take care of all the immigrant or all the refugee we bring in this country, especially if they are low skill. And I think there is some truth in that statement. So they have done this study, the net effect. So if we have an open border and we bring all of the immigrant, all the refugee, regardless of education and skill, they are going to contribute some, but at the same time, we have to develop a safety net for these people, especially if they're bringing some older relatives. They are not producing that much, and they might become a burden. And I think that's fair. That we got to be fair. We look at that one. And they study indicate that there is a net loss of $299 billion a year. If we follow the same policy of open border and we bring people regardless of a skill and say we accept every refugees, the net effect in the long run is going probably $299 billion a year. And I think that's the fact, and we have to accept that. So again, I have to be fair. I have to be honest. I told you what are the benefits of immigration, and I'm here saying obviously, I said it, and I got to be consistent. I said, I'm not one of those immigrants. I come to this country. I make it. I said, I made it. Let's close the door. Absolutely not. I want to make that one very clear. But we need at the same time to come up with a smarter, compassionate, immigration policy. Maybe we more or less do something that Canadians are doing. Say, look, we accept this percentage of the lowest skilled people, but we might also say we might want to give a little bit of priority to people who can come with a certain skill that we are lacking in this country. And we say, well, look, you know, and with the refugees, you know, maybe we want to say, look, you know, if there is no other options, you know, then we got to allow the refugees to come if they have no other option or alternative. So it's not that easy. It's very complicated. And I get it. I really get it, you know, that what is good and what is bad, you know, about immigration. But it's a complicated issue. But I'm glad the person or a group of individuals asked that question. So it's, otherwise, it's going to be one-sided. Is everybody great? Hallelujah. Let's go home. And that's the reason I like this conference, because when I go to economic conferences, I told my colleagues, we are part of a cult. We believe everything we say. You know, there is not that much debate and discussion because we understand each other's language. So thank you.
I think immigration policy to some degree can be improved, undoubtedly. But actually, refugees are well documented, well controlled, go into specific communities where the community has organizations that provide jobs, that help them with health care, that help them with schools. I don't believe that on the whole, refugees have created any kind of difficulty for the United States. Obviously, we can't take all refugees, but we should take a portion of refugees, certainly from countries where we've contributed to the disaster within the country. And we have in the case of Syria. We have in the case of Yemen, perhaps to some degree even in the case of Egypt. So there is a certain responsibility that if U.S. national policy takes us far and wide in trying to protect our interests and those result in refugees, then we have some obligation to take those refugees, and on the whole, those refugees have become good citizens. People say we're against immigration because they're engaged in drug trafficking, they take drugs, some even say they're rapists and murderers. The statistics do not indicate that immigrants or even illegal immigrants they are usually better behaved citizens than American citizens. So I think there is a lot of ignorance flying around about immigration and about immigrants. It's a lot of fake news because of most immigrants are the kind of citizens this country needs and wants.
The opening where it seems, you know, that it seems obvious that I'm in favor of immigration. Even if I was opposed to it, I'm not sure that my opposition or anyone's opposition is going to stop immigration. So then I think we need to deal in reality, which is that there is immigration. There's documented immigration, authorized immigration, and there's undocumented, unauthorized immigration. I think when we talk about how much is being spent and wasted, almost everything now, if you look at the requirements, do not accord to anyone who is here in an unauthorized status. So, you know, it's very hard to get health care. You're not going to be eligible for most Medicaid unless it's emergency. And I still think it's in our best interest to treat someone in an emergency room. You know, if we got them health care, it'd be much cheaper, but that's a completely other conversation. You know, that if you come here as a refugee, you get health care for 6 months. And you get some help with work, and you get some help with housing, but that has to be contributed by your community. So to say that we are investing an enormous amount in unauthorized immigrants or in refugees and asylees to this country is really not true. And I think if you look at the gateway states in this country that are receiving the majority of both unauthorized immigrants and refugees and asylees, that you have California, Texas, Florida, and New York. California is really progressive. New York is doing a great job. I dare you to move to Texas voluntarily. And then there's Florida, which is also one of those states. And so, you know, I think that it is a really mixed bag of how individuals who come to this country are received and are able to benefit just out of the largesse of the government and of the community. It really does become a case that you might have a grandma who's got chronic kidney disease and she's now going to need dialysis, and that isn't a costly intervention. But by and large, folks who come here are not the weakest. They are not the most in need. They are not the most, you know, unable, because they wouldn't survive. I mean, when you look at immigration out from other countries, the assessment that gets made is not we're going to flip a coin and whoever wins gets in. Internally, there's the assessment of who's going to be the most successful, who's going to get there and survive. We're all going to pool our money and help that person get there. And those are how emigration decisions are made. So to be in favor, to not be in favor, I don't think that that's really the issue. I think the reality is that there is immigration. So how do we deal with it well? I think we look at the entire system of laws, at how they are applied, at equitable application of that, of equitable distribution of the information about how it's done well, and then a system that says, okay, if this is really the process that you need to go through, we're going to make it available to everyone. So we have a cap on the total number of folks who come into the country in a year. There's a quota that you can live with. But I think that there are decisions that can be made that select and limit according to what we believe we can manage, but that they need to be clearly stated, equitably applied, and then everyone needs to understand. Thank you.
I'd like to add what Vicky said about, you know, sometimes maybe United States have a little bit of responsibility as why some of these refugees are coming to our country. Maybe United States have a moral obligation to help those people out. I'm not a political refugee, but when I came to this country from Iran in 1977, my goal as a young person growing up in a relatively very poor family was to come and get my advanced degree, and be honest with you, maybe it was naive or stupid, to go home and become the productive member of Iranian society. And some of you probably know, the older people in the audience, that what role the United States play in my country, especially in 1953, when we had elected officials, you know, to help our country, and the CIA and the United States, with the help of British, to orchestrate a coup d'etat, and they got rid of the elected official and brought the Shahs back. So again, I'm not looking for a sympathy. I'm saying we kind of be a little bit realistic and say, well, look, why this goofy guy standing here and going on and on and on? If those things didn't happen in my country, probably I was at home, and you didn't have to deal with people like me. Yeah, thank you.
So we have about 7 minutes left, and I am, you know, overwhelmed with the amazing questions here, so I apologize we can't get to all of them. So I'm going to throw out two, hoping that you can either pick and choose, you know, or address both of them if you can. And one is, this is the question is specifically about Mexico and the Mexican government, but I'm going to broaden the question a little bit, saying, what role do other countries have in this discussion, right? So we're only talking about immigration as being kind of very one-sided from U.S. policy. And the second question, because this is, you know, hosted on our campus and there are a number of students in the audience, there's a question from students about how can young people get involved and advocate for human rights and immigrant rights or not, depending on their position. This particular question was about immigrant rights, and Vicky, you said, you know, get out and vote. But I think any specifics, I know when I teach on race and immigration, there's always, you know, the end of, wow, that was a depressing sociology class about inequality. What can we do about all of this? So any insight that you have to bear on that question, I think, would be well taken.
Well, I mean, I think the point was made earlier that net migration from Mexico now is zero to negative. So I think that what also needs to happen is that we need to be clear that all brown faces are not from Mexico, that a majority of those emigrating now are from the Northern Triangle, so it's Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And that if you look at what was just said, certainly the U.S. had a huge role in destabilizing El Salvador, what's going on in Honduras, and, you know, you could say in large part what's going on in Guatemala as well. So the U.S. has a huge responsibility in those areas because they had an enormous impact. They were serving their own basic self-interest. When you read about banana republics, this is where they were front and center. That those are the places where people are coming, and indeed they have a reasonable fear. They should be able to make that kind of an application as an asylum seeker, because the return, you know, I run an international project where we manage folks who are moving back and forth with a healthcare need. And we, in a two-year period, helped about 38, no, many more, but we had about 38 people from Honduras that we were able to note that they died at the end when we were trying to communicate with them, and that only two of them died from the disease entity that we were trying to assist them with. The rest were murdered. And I think that that's a reality that we need to pay attention to. So there is that. What is the U.S. role? What is our responsibility? What is the reality on the ground in these places where people are coming to, and not confusing all brown people to be from one place, but to understand that we're distributed broadly. And then the other piece is that I think students, more than anything else, need to vote. And they need to be registered to register people to vote, and they need to vote locally, and they need to vote regionally, and they need to vote nationally, and they need to vote consistently, and they need to be educated voters.
Well, I think we have a special relationship with Latin America and with South America from the Monroe Doctrine on, that we are the most sovereign country of the area. We will control what goes on throughout South and Central and Latin America. We used to have a very interventionist policy, which you referred to, which gave us a certain responsibility for what has happened in some of these countries. We also returned to many of these countries' gang members who didn't fit in and then contributed to some of the violence that's now pushing people out. But the point I'd like to make, which certainly isn't part of our immigration policy, is that if we think we have a special status in Latin America, then maybe we have to give a special status to Latin Americans who wish to come to the United States. Maybe the quotas on immigration should be higher for Latin America, or maybe there should be more lotteries in Latin America. Just to go back for 1 minute to how we decide on who's coming to the United States legally. The first category is family. So if you're an immigrant from Iran, from Iraq, from Mexico, as soon as you become a U.S. citizen, you can apply for your family. Actually, as soon as you have a green card, you can apply for your family. So that's the major category. So if we have more Mexicans, immigrants than any other nationality, the Mexican population will likely grow more than any other nationality. Then, as I mentioned, we have refugees. Then we have visas for students. We have visas for special categories of work, which are underrepresented, in which we can't find the people we need. A lot of Indians, Chinese, Asians are coming to fill in technology jobs in Silicon Valley, et cetera, professors. So there is a system of immigration that should work. I think what really doesn't work is using immigration as a scapegoat. And we just have to stop that, you know. And if it helped President Trump get elected, we have to be smart enough to look and say, okay, it might have helped him in certain areas, but is this true? Does a wall in Mexico make sense? No, we already have a partial wall, and immigration from Mexico is not a major issue any longer.
We're running out of time, and it's lunchtime. So I'm going to be very quick. In a spirit of fairness, you know, I think that was a good question. And I'm just mentioning, you know, maybe the United States played directly or indirectly a role for me being here, you know, for 4 years. But at the same time, we've got to be honest. I think I blame the government of Iran, the government of Mexico, a lot of developing countries. Because a lot of those people, they'd rather be at home with their family and in their own country. So sometimes it's not by choice, folks, it's by force, you know. And I think, you know, those countries, they got to take some responsibility because some of them, if not all of them, are corrupted and they are not producing the basics for their own population. A lot of these people interested, and maybe this is a common characteristic of all the population, they're interested to make themselves rich and their friends. And I think this is a major problem in the developing countries, and we cannot always point our finger to bad United States, you know, they're doing all the bad things. Those people are doing also a good job, you know, not treating their own population well.
Okay, that concludes our panel. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to our panelists.